is a production of Cornell University.
Well, good afternoon. It's January 27th at 4:33, and I'd like to call this meeting of the University Assembly to order. Thank you, everyone, for attending. We have some special guests here. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, are there any late additions to the agenda? Hearing none, let's move on quickly to the approval of the December 2nd, 2014 Assembly Minutes. Are there any changes or corrections?
Motion to approve.
Motion on the floor. I ask unanimous consent to approve the minutes of December 2nd, 2014 as presented to you earlier. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. And we'll turn to our first business item of the day, which is the provost search. We'd like to welcome Dean Alan Matthews, Rebecca Q. and James C. Morgan, Dean of the College of Human Ecology, and also the Vice Chair of the Provost Search Committee. He's joined by John Celestiano. Did I get it close? Thank you, sir, for coming. The Senior Vice Provost for Academic Affairs and also on the Provost Search Committee. We are expecting probably before their discussion is over, Professor Kim Hines-Eitzen. She is a professor in the Departments of Near Eastern Studies and Classics and the Religious Studies Program, and we hope that she'll be able to join us. And we also have Lisa Yeager from the Office of the President. Welcome, Lisa. Before they get started, and for their benefit, I'd ask that we go around the room and just make brief introductions. Why don't we start with you, Randy? Oh, I'm sorry, Ron. I didn't see you, Ron Booker. We'll start with Ron Booker.
Matt Pataglia, I'm an undergrad in ILR, and I'm the vice chair.
Jim Blair, chair of the assembly.
Middle cell staff, CIT.
Sarah Ballack, undergraduate, president of the student assembly.
Juliana Bustica, undergraduate in ILR, and vice president of the student assembly.
Chris?
Chris Schaefer from the biomedical engineering department.
Welcome. And that's Lisa Yeager. And in the back? Thank you.
I'm Connor Hodges. I serve on the campus codes and judicial committee under Randy.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Sir, the floor is yours for 25 minutes.
Thank you very much. Before coming here, I looked at my wall. I have a certificate of appreciation of serving on the assembly in 2002. I signed by Hunter Rollin, Hope Manville, I believe, and Hank Collette. So for those who've been around for a while, those names are infamous. I just want to thank you for your time. I mean, mostly here to listen to input from you about what you want us to look for in the next program. It's a very sensitive, compatible system to me. As dean, I'm hiring, the committee is hiring my next boss. So we need a very good program. And also the chair of the committee is president-elect, Jeff Garrett. So I just wanted to start by telling you that we have an outside search firm assisting in the search. And to start, we've gotten several questions over time about internal search versus external search. We're really looking for the best candidate in the pool, and there's no pre-screened preference for internal or external. Really, we're just looking for the best candidate. The other thing I'll say is the provost really touches the assembly of students, faculty, and staff. And the provost touches a lot of all three constituents very deeply. And in many ways, as much as the president is very external, focused at some level, the provost is really helps run the whole internal operation of the university through guiding academic programs, which obviously impacts students, and by setting budget priorities for all units, including the non-academic side of the shop as well. So this is a very, very important person. He or she is going to really have an impact on the direction of the university. So we're taking this extremely seriously, trying to find the right place. So we have provided to you the search statement that we have made. This is a combined effort of the experience. Actually, John had a lot of input in John has done a lot of searches for the university and helped him. And so we used his wisdom in coming up with some of this material. Then it went to all of us on the search committee to be a great dialogue about it. And so this is the final version of the search statement that is on the website. This sort of summarizes both the position and what we expect of people. But what we want to learn from these sessions is really, there's a lot of attributes we talk about in here. And we want to know really what if you were interviewing the provost, what represented you in interviewing candidates, what do you want us to look for? What are the characteristics that you think are most important that will help us?
No, other than to repeat again that most people at Cornell obviously know who the president is. Very few actually run into the provost, but the provost has the second most significant position at Cornell. Formerly the chief academic officer, so all of the deans, all of the colleges report to the provost. The provost governs all the budget. And basically much of the internal operations of the university in both research and teaching are the responsibility of the provost. So as Alan said, it's very, very significant, is a somewhat hidden position in the university. And so any issues or questions or concerns you have along the lines of how the university operates as an educational research institution are pertinent to our process of looking for the next provost.
And I will add that there will be a site for nominations, so to the committee for names and suggestions. So is that site on operation?
Yes, and actually in the back of that, and after the statement, there's a few more for them to submit nominations
to the search. So we're more than happy to nominate anyone on the search committee. We'll together look at those nominations.
Do you have a way that you would like, if folks have feedback for the search, or, you know, as you said, desired characteristics that they think are important, how can we constructively submit those to you? We did this for the presidential search. They did a data collection process and had an email to submit that to see what was on everybody's mind. So do you have a similar process?
We have a provost search website.
And the email is provost@cornell.edu.
So use that document.
That is held highly confidential. That's right. And only members of the search committee have a passcode to that information. So it will be held very confidential. We have all signed, the entire search committee has signed confidentiality agreements that we do not share any information we have talked about or any questions really. What we can say publicly is what we're willing to say for the meeting and what the public information on the website is. But this site is confidential, so you can share whatever you want knowing what you want to say with the community.
What is your hopeful timeline for concluding the search? When do you hope to have a provost in place?
We hope to have a provost in place by the fall.
And I would add to that some concerns of the assembly in the presidential search, and I will presume that they apply to the provost search. There's concern that through the search firm that you're using and the process that you employ, that you ensure you have a diverse pool of candidates, regardless of who you decide. And in the president search, we noted that there was some concern on some constituents that to get a diverse pool, you have to go to potentially not normal places to advertise. And there are people that I know are probably advising you, but if not, I can forward some names that express some concerns just to make sure that the pool at the end of the day that you consider is diverse. And as a more concrete something that assembly members think of, and it's a balancing act, but somebody who has proven results, not just a CV or whatever, but proven results showing a balance of strong collaboration on one hand and the ability to make decisions and move forward on the other. And obviously people draw that line in different places, but we all who've been around for a while have met people who have the academic potential to be a great provost and no experience doing it. And we have other people who run corporations and not so familiar with the fully collaborative environment of an academic institution. And so being cognizant of having a provost that can be both effective as well as getting the input that you would expect in an academic environment. Gina, did you have a question or comment?
I just was going to ask you if you would please just repeat that URL for the provost search.
I will look up the URL, but the email is provostsearch@cornell.edu where comments can be.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And that was all I needed. I didn't realize there was an email. Thank you.
So, Jim, so under ideal experience in the search statement, you talk about that they have at least to give you administrative leadership experience, and by that you mean improving the intent of that is that a proven result from that leadership, not just that they will lead.
So I've worked with this search firm for a number of searches, and they're very good at casting a wide net. We're very aware of the importance of having a diverse portfolio, and also agree on your on the question of experience. As a general matter, provost for huge elite research universities such as ours will typically be, not always, because we want to look broadly, and that's partly how we diversify the pool, but they will typically be past or present sitting deans, particularly of complicated units, provosts at other institutions, or vice provosts, potentially college presidents at smaller universities. So as Alan said, we would obviously be wise to look at somebody where there's a proven track record. In searches, you particularly for a position like this, you don't always have somebody who's done everything for that position. You want to see some strong experience and obviously academic credentials, but the rest you can reasonably infer that if they don't have the experience, they have the capacity to get up to speed. So that's how we try to approach it.
Obviously, it should be looking for somebody who not just doesn't apply, but has the energy to do the job at this level. I mean, I'm always astounded by President Scorton's travel schedule, and I'm sure the president or the provost has to hold down the fort a lot more. But it's a high-demand job, and I don't know how long your search for. I mean, are you looking for a provost for 5 to 7 years, or are you looking for somebody for 15, or that's really not part of your A-list of considerations?
That actually is not something that we've discussed in a sense. I think if one can look at the average length of a provost at Cornell, that is from, so Billy Martin was the longest standing provost. She was provost for 8 years, just to put it into a perspective. And Kent Fox was, I think, in his sixth year of provost. Part of the dilemma always is very effective provost at Cornell, your thought for presidency is notable. So, you're really focused on getting the right person at this time. You don't have a 10-year, but we're not looking for someone, frankly, I'm not looking for someone just to come in for a year or two. You really want someone who's pretty committed to the long-term success of the university.
Other members' questions?
Perfect.
Just a second, Professor Hatch.
Oh, sorry. I'm just wondering, just
provost deals with Cutter, with Weil as well, right?
No, so actually, at many universities, yes, but at this university, there's a separate provost for the murals.
For
Weil. For Weil, and Cutter.
And Cutter.
And Cutter.
Not
for
Weil Tech.
It's here.
It's here. Right. Okay. And then the information-based or internet-based education to educational policy, so my question is, what is the prioritization in mind? I mean, I wouldn't say re-examine priorities and make difficult decisions. The examining priorities, one of the things that comes to mind is you have a campus here, a large campus here, and it's a land-based district. How does that fit in charge with about prioritization of resource allocation, energy allocation of this vibrant community versus the technologically based, internet based, or Weil or Cornell Tech?
That's a great question. I would say, without violating the confidence of this, there's a sense in which there's not a clear change in priorities one way or the other that anyone thinking about, but new leadership, new president, you know, we everything always probably should be re-examined at some level. So this notion of, so for example, online learning, we started with groups, what priority does that have for new provost and new president? We just don't know, and we want someone who's going to be analytical and strategic in thinking about those priorities, and that's probably what we want to hear from you. What types of characteristics we want in a provost? Is it going to be, things are not going well at Cornell, we have to change everything? There's some element in which we want to hear some feedback about provost. I will say that by in writing the search statement as we did, it's clear that the Cornell Tech campus is a priority at some level. We started it, we made a commitment to it, and so it's a priority at some level. That's not to say that any distraction from the Ithaca campus or, but a provost is going to have to juggle those demands of their time and effort to balance all of these things. In many ways, not having medical school under its supervision and simplifying things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. There's a follow-up.
We'll come back to that. Tasia?
Yeah, I just wanted a clarification on what responsibility center and budget monitoring goes to the
Do you
want to
do it or do you want
to
do
it? So the university prior to the downturn had a historically cobbled together extremely complicated model for allocation of funding that comes in through all doors and went out through all sorts of doors. And the provost played a role in trying to keep that incredibly complicated machinery running. When the downturn occurred, we had an actual financial stress, but it was also clear that our budgeting models prevented us from effectively dealing with the complexity of our financial position. The prior provost, Kent Fox, led a five-year effort to simplify and streamline the budgeting process. It's known what the outcome of that is what's known as a responsibility-centered budget model, which means that the units who take in revenues, for example, the colleges, are largely responsible for the allocation of those revenues, rather than having multiple flows all through different pockets on campus. And so the provost, who has primary budget authority, has to be somebody that's reasonably familiar with that way of thinking about the complexity of university budgets. And so there is a slight indication of preference for that familiarity. That said, I think a good candidate coming from any kind of budgetary model would be able to understand and adapt to Cornell's situation. We're still unfolding that budget model. It's had a number of complexities and implications, and so this is, again, a place where a certain amount of adeptness is going to be required. But anyone we're looking at, that will be their financial smarts would be something that
Others? Yes, Juliana.
Yes. To build off Professor Hatch's comment in terms of the Ithaca campus, has there been any thought or what's the outlook of the committee in terms of potential provost interview in STEM fields versus humanity fields? I know there's growing concern about focus on the STEM fields, which a lot of people think is great, but neglecting you know, lesser up and coming fields at this campus.
So I think the part of the reason the search committee looks like it does is to reflect the diversity of interests across both Ithaca and Cornell Tech. So we try to get people in STEM fields, in humanities, in social sciences, really in advanced sciences, all working together under the committee so that there's equal voice to you know, in this committee to help work through the candidates. That's, again, I think if these are, there's no going in saying we need someone in STEM or in humanities, where the candidates will flow from the qualities we're listing, and where they fall is going to be an interesting thing. So if we hear time after time we go to meeting, it must be someone in humanities, that's information that's helpful to us, at least to know what our communities are thinking. And this is partly why we're getting feedback. There's no predetermined search for anything in particular except what we go down this campus.
I would just follow up. You know, I think your question is a very good one because at a university like this, or in fact, you see it everywhere, there's a lot of anxiety about what fields might be favored or disfavored. And because the provost has such a central role in that question, the budget, and allocation, and that's a normal concern. And so we are acutely aware of it. We've been aware of it in every search that's occurred about making sure that all parts of Cornell are taken care of well. This concern has been a bit elevated in recent years because of Cornell's investment in New York Tech, or Cornell Tech in New York City. That causes anxiety on campus about flows of resources. But I can tell you from sort of inside the sausage factory that every president provost I've worked with has been very sensitive to that. The first draft of how you would deal with that is to make sure that if the president is from one area, the provost is from another. And that's been sort of a thought for many years, is if the president is from the humanities side of the discipline, then you should put the provost from the science side. Nice in theory, but the world is actually much more complex than that. And so if you look over the past practices, several provosts ago, the president, Hunter Rawlings, was from classics, and the provost, Biddy Martin, was from German studies. So that would say, wow, it's all concentrated in the arts college. On the other hand, those two are looked back as having been very favorable to the sciences, and that started the Life Science Initiative here, because they made extraordinary efforts to be attentive to areas that weren't home but were essential to Cornell. Under the last iteration, David Gordon was in medicine and engineering, and Kent Fox was in engineering, yet they, and particularly David Gordon, paid a great deal of attention to humanities. So any good leader is going to be a leader of all of Cornell, and what we would select against in this process is anyone we had a sense of who is, as provost, favoring their home team. That would be something to avoid greatly. So if they're from one area, we want to make sure that they're literate and focused on the other part of the corner. Very good question.
Can I just ask one more thing?
Yes, please.
Just at least from the student's perspective, you're probably hearing this from the students on the search committee, but 14 destinations has been critical in shaping student life, and especially because it came from the credibility of the provost's office. And at least for me, it's great to see that's one of the critical competencies of success, and I really commend you for that as well.
Chris?
Just to be negative, but one thing that everything, you ignore everything before the bus. Right? So one thing that I noticed when I looked at the makeup of the search committee is it lacks representation from assistant professors or even recently tenured faculty. In an institution where we are going to have a substantial turnover in the faculty during the tenure of this fellow, I thought that an unfortunate oversight.
I think that's a legitimate criticism. Putting these committees together is very difficult in terms of getting sufficient representation across many, and the age demographic here is tilted decidedly towards more senior faculty.
Following up on Professor Schaefer's comment, I would commend to you there are obviously relatively easy ways to overcome some of that by holding forums with those groups, either organized via the Faculty Senate or others through the colleges. And I guess you've obviously come here soliciting some sense of input. Who else are you planning to visit? What have you developed a full roadmap of?
So we work with Gina on seeing all the formal assemblies. So we're going to the Faculty Senate, we're going to the we haven't scheduled the graduate professional student assembly yet. Going to the student assembly,
Well, but I would also commend to you, you know, some subsets of the faculty. I'm certainly you'll visit the colleges. I know the deans will have input. They'll put their input in whether it's asked or not. But some of the younger, quieter faculty, especially if they're not yet tenured, that's a strong voice, and they might be a little more hesitant and would probably appreciate being asked to a forum rather than, you know, working through in informal chains. Obviously, it's, you know, your search, and I'm sure it's in great hands. Professor Booker?
Do you guys plan on having guests on to the
questions? This is all done at the behest of the incoming president back here. She's the chair of the committee. I don't know if we have not addressed the final stage. It's an interesting question. In the dean searches, which are one, you know, tier down, they typically do have some open. At the presidential searches, which is one tier up, they're absolutely locked down. People who wait till the smoke comes out. I am not sure what that preference is on.
We usually have stories to the voice. Better picture,
Yeah.
Good question.
Mr. Battaglia.
Just following up on Juliana and Jim's point, just for trying to solicit opinions from students, I would recommend going outside the assembly system as well, just because if anyone who's ever been to a student assembly meeting, you get a lot of people who are fairly regular, but if you're just an agenda item, I wouldn't say that you draw a crowd that wouldn't generally come. Sorry, to be completely honest
Thank
with you.
Thank you for the candor.
But Cornell is such a huge, I mean, we're over 14,000 undergrads, and you'll get such a small subset if you only look at the student assembly. So I would just like to recommend and echo the idea that maybe put an open forum in Goldensmith or an advertising the Sun and try and get the less traditional aspect, because there's so many different opinions and so many valid opinions. If you limit yourself just to the assembly system, you're going to narrow out a lot of the student voice, because the student assembly won't get the breadth of the entire body.
Please.
Yeah, just to build off of what Kevin Blair was saying, Cornell has a number of really successful, really large units, and they're all very, very complicated. If you look at student sentiment as measured by the Climate Diversity Report, if you look at students' general descriptions and the general ethos of Cornell around the country, that's like a huge institution. There's no one unifying factor. And that means there are a lot of really excellent programs that don't know about each other. There are a lot of really excellent groups that work in the same field doing amazing things that don't, there are linkages to be made. There's arbitrage there and value for the university. I think a really good candidate would be able to efficiently manage those relationships and be able to meet all of those groups upon getting here and get quickly acclimated. And we should look at universities like that can. You know, you can't just spit out one message again and again at Cornell, because it's such a diverse body. There's not one thing, like, you know, it's not football at Penn State. There's no equivalent. And we really need somebody that can do that, especially because of all the change at the top.
Primary part of the job, the provost, so there is one person, he or she, will sit there and see the university and all its strengths located in facilitate and bring people together. The word collaboration is actually mentioned specifically around someone that fosters it and manages it as a collaborative style of bringing people together. But it's a very good point.
Yeah. Cornell is, in my view, the most complex American university, probably the most complex university in the world. It's public, it's private, it's land grant, it's Ivy, which is in more fields than any other American university. So this problem is a recurring challenge, is that we have so much going on here, and so much going on that could tie into so much else in the disciplinary fields and the programs and areas of interest. And the provost does, as Alan says, sits at a pivotal role. So we spend a lot of time just essentially matchmaking, trying to bring together deans or faculty of different areas, and it goes on throughout. So a successful provost has to be one that is very good at working with complexity.
And just so you know, that the current provost, intro provost, and the prep and the past provost, the deans, 2 hours every week where we talk exactly about how to build collaborations across colleges, across the graduate schools there. A lot of times the vice presidents are there, the vice provosts are there. So this is what the provost tries to do, is really bring us all together. It's a corny term, one Cornell, but the provost does worry about that term.
Well, and I guess the feedback I'm hearing today, and this is a recurring theme from the assemblies, is there are a lot of unheard voices, and is the president generally bears the brunt of it, but if people don't feel like they have been heard, you will see the protest at Day Hall, even though you may have been working on it at some level. Certainly we expect provosts to have to work with the deans and the senior administration of the university, but increasingly we're finding, especially with electronic and modern communications techniques and everything else, that the rank and file, when they want to know something, they want to be able to find the information. It's partly a technology issue, but it's also partly a provost or a president who goes to the colleges and is constantly walking the beat and not in their office in meetings, but also spending a certain time out and about hearing the things that maybe they don't hear, or even if they do hear, the people who don't know that, actually seeing them, knowing their face, knowing their name, and believing that they are, you know, making those decisions in a thoughtful manner. So I know you know that, but it's always a part of that. Gina?
Just to follow up on that, I think actually the assemblies, the individual assemblies and the university assembly can help towards that, you know, that from the constituents through the assemblies and then through the administration and leadership who look forward to being a part of those communications. And I just have to say, I appreciate the efforts that you're making to hear from the different assemblies and the constituents, even at this level. It's been very received very, very well. So everybody sort of feels like there's at least somebody that represents them having a voice at the table. So thank you very much.
We're getting near the end of our time. Let's have Mr. Walworth and Professor Hatch, and then see if we can wrap this up.
So just a comment that I had on certain problems is that graduate students often have sort of, or middle age student being a student, being an employee, in a lot of cases, sort of teaching assistants, research assistants. So I just ask that, you know, as we do candidates, to try and find somebody who's sensitive to the fact that graduate students are an older population, there's going to be a larger percentage of them with family issues, in terms of, you know, actually having a family at home to be taken care of, and also the need to have pseudo employees in addition to being a student.
Professor Hatch?
This is in the nature of the follow-up that I think has been broached in several different ways. Touched upon Gerald and Liz. I mean, when you talk about fortifying or keeping them lively and energetic and hungry at this campus and the many people that are brought here, what comes to my mind is that this is creating a community and creating a new language that's influx of new people. And creating a community means not just bringing them here and giving them a whole bunch of courses to choose from, but it's also some kind of socialization process that, and Provost is the chief academic officer, but the academics are important in creating that socialization process is essential. We're looking for people to think about others in different ways, not just their biological makeup or their organization, although those are very important. But, and I remember two things that have happened over the past 40 years. One is a provost that decided what was important was a unit on values, social values, interpersonal values, values of diversity were part of it, but you know, other things that is. And then another provost developing the reading project, which was, these were two important, to my mind, cognizance, if there's a word, of the essential role of the provost in setting a climate of inquiry that leads to a dynamic and vibrant community that then contributes as it goes out, congratulates, commends, to the vibrance and the strength of the society. And I think something's been missing, at least I have a jaded view of what's happened recently, in the sense that there's just a lot of bankers to this topic, but the value side of things has been missing, and society is suffering from it. And if Cornell wants to have its level of excellence in diversity and all of these other things be really beacon, it wants to, be the great university, the one that has everything going on in it for the reason. It really has to examine that, and the provost has to have that as a cause. Sorry.
Thank you.
On that,
sir.
I think, you know, the engaged Cornell, like the group that's really trying to both work with faculty and students on engaging the communities broadly is a priority that Beth Barrett, she knew about the gift when she accepted the presidency, which was about that time, and committed to that, and we've been working about it publicly outside of our search committee publicly. And I don't see that any provost would possibly not be supportive of that. And that is a culture change a little bit, certainly around that North Valley.
Nice question has come up with us about this situation between people that know the price of everything because of that.
Right. There are probably some questions that have not been asked. There also may be some questions from some members that they didn't feel like they had it penned out well enough to articulate. Please think about those. Send them to me. 1 week from today, I will email the search committee with the assembly's overall arching thoughts on the matter. Not to, that it's a, you know, that's it, but you've heard a lot of the feedback. I'll try and summarize what you've heard, anything else I get, and we'll send you something in a brief bullet point thing about representing our overall views. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you also have things you want to pass through the assemblies, don't hesitate to send it to Gina or to me, and I will get it to the members and out to our constituencies.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very, very much. Do you have anything to display?
Well, we set up Professor Schaefer for his presentation. If anybody wants to grab some food, please feel free.
Cora, you're going to be over there at the door.
Oh.
Well, the path of the information.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, next item on the agenda, I'm going to ask for your unanimous consent to deviate from the orders of the day. Professor Schaefer has to get back to his house and I assume a dining engagement or meeting. And so I would like to move him up to item 3, subsection 2. And presuming your unanimous consent, Professor Schaefer, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today. And I apologize for forcing you to change your order. The thing on the order of business, I'm actually on the faculty in residence at Donlan Hall. And one of the events we do there every other Tuesday night is what we call a Donlan Dinner, where all of the faculty associated come and have dinner at the residence hall with or at one of the eating hall, I don't know what you call it, the cafeteria, with the students, and that's starting in about 45 minutes. I don't want to miss that if I organize it.
Well, thank you for taking the time.
I appreciate you being flexible. So what I'd like to talk about today is a committee that I'm chairing and the work we're doing to investigate the possibility of Cornell adopting an open access policy. And I'll talk about both what that means and what we've been doing so far. So there was a University Assembly resolution passed last spring, which established a committee to investigate this. The resolution set a broad makeup from the committee and suggested a few questions. It also asked us to report back by November 2014. So as you can see, we're a little bit behind there. But actually, for not that reason. It turns out that last year has been a very complex year in the area of open access, with both a lot of movement by universities to adopt institutional open access policies, a lot of movement at the federal agency level in mandating open access to federally funded research, as well as a lot of movement in the space of journals in terms of their acceptance of this open access stuff. And to tell you the truth, there's a sense that there's some things that need to shake out a little bit before we can make really good decisions. A lot of those things are shaking out now, and I'm confident that we'll be able to wrap up a nice report towards the end of the spring, which we would anticipate presenting to the new administration. So, in terms of the Open Access Committee, so I'm chairing. We have another five faculty members, representation from the library, postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduates from the university. Faculty are chosen from across a variety of fields, humanities, social sciences, veterinary medicine, and heart science. So let me just talk a little bit about what open access is, what it means, why it might be something that we would be interested in pursuing. So the idea of open access is to make scholarly work freely available to the interested reader. Now, the first time I talked about this, I was actually kind of shocked. Somebody said, oh, but you know what, you're not going to get paid for the papers you publish? So let me just set that straight. Faculty are not paid. We're not paid at all for publishing scholarly work. And the things I'm describing about here would not apply to things that you would typically be remunerated for, so writing a book, producing a movie, or a soundtrack, or something like that. So we're not talking about open access to things that are traditionally sold. Rather, we're talking about open access, or things where the creator is paid for the production. Rather, we're talking about things like scholarly work where there is no remuneration for the author. So if it's freely available to the reader, that means there's no subscription fee. That doesn't mean the publishing is free, and I think that's something that's very important to remember. These costs are just shifted. So in open access model, the costs of publishing are not covered by subscriptions, but are shifted to other sources, to author fees, to university, or professional society subsidies, things like that. There's sort of two broad classes of open access that is being promoted right now. The first is just an open access journal. So this is a journal where when you publish in it, anything that's published is freely available from the web, from day one. There's sort of mixed model journals where things become available after some embargo period, or where as an author you can pay an additional fee for something to be open access to begin. So I'm not going to be talking about open access journals going forward. What I'm going to be talking about are what's called open access repositories. The idea is to have copies of the scholarly work made available on a discipline-specific or an institutionally hosted repository. And this is separate from the journal published company. So this means the journal is still handling the peer review, the decision to publish, all of these kinds of things. And after that happens, an additional copy of that article is made available either through a discipline-specific or an institutional repository, and it's through that other repository that those who do not have subscriptions to the journal would be able to get access to the information. Cornell already has one of these repositories. It's called the e-commons. It's dramatically underutilized. And it's not surprising that it's dramatically underutilized. So the experience has been that repositories, whether most of them, whether discipline-specific or institutional, tend to be underutilized unless it becomes a requirement. Now, there's a few cases where it's sort of become almost it's become so standard in the field that the requirement is sort of like this is just how the field operates, and that's true in certain areas of physics and astronomy with an archive that's actually a repository that's posted here at Cornell called Archive. Many federal funding agencies are now requiring open access versions be available, often after an embargo period of 6 to 12 months, depending on how the journal negotiated. The logic behind this is that if the taxpayers fund the research, they should be able to read the results of it. And it's quite hard to argue with that. This began at the National Institutes of Health with PubMed Central, which was, again, one of these repositories where people could voluntarily deposit papers. About 4% of papers published were deposited. Then it became a requirement. It went up to about 70% of papers that were supposed to be deposited there were. And then they said, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you can't get another NIH grant. And so now it's like 95%. So these kinds of these kinds of mandates can work. Recently, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, or the White House, has directed other federal funding agencies, any federal agency that funds more than $100 million of research per year, to implement a similar open access policy. The Department of Energy just rolled out their policy a couple of weeks ago, and we expect the next few big ones, National Science Foundation, NASA, NIST, in the coming months. So this is in part why we slowed things down a little bit. There's also many discipline-specific archives. For example, Archives Built Within Text is actually hosted here at Cornell. Has approximately 1 million articles in it that cover disciplines of physics, astronomy, certain areas of physics, mostly high energy physics, cosmology, astronomy, and some computer stuff. One thing you asked is, what does this do to copyright? So, you know, when you publish a paper with a journal, you usually sign a transfer of copyright agreement. There's a couple ways this can work. The thing that is copyrighted is actually the final formatted version of the article. The original version that you submitted, you do not hand copyright over to. So the author can always submit to these institutional repositories a preprint of an article. And then most institutional open access policies actually modify the publisher agreement, so that you don't transfer all copyright. Instead, the author and the university retain a right to a non-exclusive right to distribute the scholarly content through one of these repositories. And this relatively simple form that you staple to the copyright agreement that you would sign with when publishing an article. You might ask, how many journals will accept these? Almost all. So almost all journals are currently okay with this. There's a few that aren't, but it's becoming a dwindling number. Although that agreement is usually with an embargo, so the journals ask that the article not be placed in the institutional repository for 6 to 12 months after it's published in their journal. The idea is that this maintains some value for a subscription. For people for places like research-intensive universities where having access to the latest research is critical for our mission, but nonetheless doesn't destroy the value of having broad access to that information over time for constituencies who maybe don't need it right away but need to have long-term access. I also want to emphasize that this is not, what we are not talking about is requiring authors to publish in open access journals. This is not something that restricts the rights of faculty to choose when and where to publish articles. And this is not a free way to publish scholarly information. In fact, if anything, the move toward open access publishing is going to shift increased financial burdens to research-intensive universities and away from research non-intensive universities. In some sense, right now, the research non-intensive universities are subsidizing us because everybody's paying subscriptions to journals, but we're the ones that use them the most. Shifting to open access would probably shift costs more toward author fees, so it's the places that publish lots of papers who would bear the cost. So that would be a place like Carnegie. So why might you consider open access? Well, as you know, there's lots of fantastic research going on at a place like Cornell that not only is valuable in the scholarly world, but is valuable more broadly. And it would be nice for this information to be broadly available. That broad availability helps the researchers. So there's been a number of studies that have demonstrated that open access articles are viewed and downloaded at a higher rate than articles that sit behind a paywall, even for researchers who are at research-intensive universities. That two extra clicks somehow slows scholars down, and they download the article a bit less. There's benefits to the university, first having a long-term archive of the scholarly work that's presented here, that's been generated here, and some sense of leadership in a global movement to make scholarly information available to all. The broadest benefits are probably more outside the realm of sort of academic scholarship. There's certainly a kind of equalizing access to information, especially information that was taxpayer funded. In support of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, there was a group of policy on open access. There were a number of Nobel laureates who suggested that this kind of open access is critical for maintaining pace in research productivity. But I would say in my own spirit, the biggest benefit is probably outside of scholarly institutions. So if you talk with scientists and other scholars at research-intensive universities, the access to scholarly information is not a particular concern. Our libraries are good enough that the information we want to have access to is quite readily available. The problem sits outside. So one of the members of our committee is a veterinarian, but also completing a PhD here at Cornell, and she gets emails weekly from veterinarians in practice who know her, asking if she could pull a paper that Cornell has pull a paper from a journal that Cornell has a subscription to, so that they would have information that they want to use in making a decision about treating a patient. So that's something very tangible, that they don't have access to information that they would like to use to inform their decisions for a particular patient. I actually spent a year working as a science policy advisor for Senator Ed Markey down in Washington, D.C., and I was shocked at how many times I had to use my Cornell library access to gain access to information that we were using to make policy decisions at the federal level. And this is a lack of federal government access to some of the information that the federal government funds. And of course, educators in the K-12 or community college system, small businesses, especially startups, would benefit from this broader access. So I think many of the real benefits of making scholarly information broadly accessible do not come to the scholarly community. They come from the impact of that scholarship outside. As you can imagine, this is extremely consistent with Cornell's mission. And in fact, Cornell has some efforts in open access already. Cornell has a small fund that will pay publication fees required in some open access journals. There's an effort to encourage faculty to publish an open access journal. Cornell hosts Archive, which is, again, I think one of the most successful discipline-specific. Paul Ginsberg, who founded and continues to manage Archive. But this is probably one of the most discipline-specific open access repositories around. And there's been a number of faculty Senate resolutions over time that have encouraged faculty to try to make information more broadly available. And yet, this is something that a couple of students who were working with me found last year, ultra-sensitive polymer detects explosive devices, something that seems like it could be really useful, and I can buy that article for $35. for 48 hours of access, unless I'm in a place like Cornell and I and the university has a subscription to it. So it's still hard to get access to a lot of the scholarships that Cornell produces as a result of these K-1s. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. There's a number of potential downsides from an institution adopting open access policy. There are costs associated with both necessary staff time and infrastructure. Experience at other universities suggests that something around 2 full-time equivalent positions required to manage something like this. Cornell's current e-commerce infrastructure is adequate, but over time it would have to be upgraded and maintained. The other thing is a question of how the policy is structured. So if posting to a repository is not mandatory in some way, then experience shows it just won't be done, and so it won't really be a valuable resource. If it is mandatory, what's the enforcement policy? Perhaps our new provost is going to walk around and chastise faculty who fail to do it. And you know, we have to think through how such a policy would really be implemented in practice. There's also a need to cleanly integrate with these federal mandates and these federal mandates that are evolving as we speak. The last thing we would want to do is to create something that was duplicated work that was already happening at the federal level in a way that was more work without additional benefit. Now, that has been handled well in some cases. The University of California produced a system that smoothly linked between PubMed and their system. You take one step to upload to an institutional open access repository, and it manages the movement of that to PubMed Central, which fulfills the federal mandate. In terms of national trends, this slide's a little old. It's more than 36 universities now, but a number of prominent universities, sort of in the research intensive class, have adopted these open access policies. And they essentially are like I say, the authors alter the publishing agreement where they retain copyright and grant the university the right to distribute it. They also grant the journal a non-exclusive right to publish the article. Again, this applies only to scholarly work, not to things that would typically be paid. All of these programs have opt-out waivers for an odd journal that does not, it won't go along with these kinds of policies. So it's possible to opt out of it, to not have an open access policy, but it has to be, it's an affirmative opt out. So you have to take a step to opt out. It's not opting in. But as I say, this is compiled from MIT. Most major publishers are already in full cooperation with these with this posting to institutional repositories, again with these embargo periods, and others are coming along. And some of the infrastructure that's been built to make this happen can be quite straightforward. So this is from the University of California system, where a single upload to both the University of California archive as well as to PubMed Central. So in terms of what our committee's plan is, we are now at an information gathering phase on broadly on open access policies, but focusing on the institutional repositories, which is our charge. We're trying to envision how these kinds of policies might match to Cornell. And we've had an ongoing effort to survey faculty, as well as graduate students, postdocs, and undergraduates involved in research. Through a number of presentations at department faculty meetings, open forums, and other areas. There's, for example, a half-day-long conference on open access that will be held in March, where I'm one of the speakers. So far, we've been meeting roughly monthly. We've had representatives from the publishing industry, the vice president for academic relations from Elsevier, for example, came and spent a couple days at Cornell to talk with us. We've also had a number of people who are scholars who study the impact of open access, because I would have to say one of the things that at least I've noticed in learning more about this is there's a lot of talk with less data, and that's not how you would like to do things, so we've asked people who study, you know, from almost a library science perspective, what the influence of open access is on the utilization of scholarly information chat with us. I'd encourage you, if you're interested, to take a look at a column that was published in November 2013 in the Cornell Daily Sun by postdoc Sunny O'Day and two graduate students, Misha and Michelle. Interestingly, they were students in a science policy class I teach. That policy class has students identify and issue at the intersection of science and public policy they care about and to try to affect change. That thing that this student group identified was open access, and they did a number of things at the federal level, but also pushed for the university resolution and published this op-ed piece advocating for Cornell to develop an open access policy. So with that, that's what I have to report at this point, and like I say, I hope we'll have a full report with both some of this sort of background, how things might map onto Cornell, as well as our recommendation and implementation policy late in the spring.
Thank you. While members are gathering any questions they might have, I think some of the problem that I don't know that you'll be able to come to a meaningful solution on is, fundamentally, in today's world, we want scholarly works independently peer-reviewed so that they have a level of credibility and oversight and things. And after that process has happened, we want to have an ISBN, and I want to be able to find it on Google. And I don't care whether it's Cornell, Harvard, MIT, someplace I've never heard of in wherever. You know, when I'm looking for information, background, scholarly work, I want to be able to find it. So its ability to connect, to be searched, to be, you know, for things to be found, is relevant. Obviously, there's a huge federal and policy piece. You know, one wonders why these journals after 6 months don't put it in their open repository, and that's some kind of new model for them. You know, but we have even here eCommons, Archive. You know, would your group be recommending on how those things would be, I mean, merged?
So,
I mean, separate. I mean, there's inefficiencies, but also expertise, you know, with a million articles, you know.
Right. So a couple of questions mixed in there that I'd be happy to address. First, I don't think that, you know, I think, for example, eCommons and Archive actually serve different purposes. So Archive, Cornell right now is subsidizing it to a great extent, but that's something that is a broad service to the high energy physics, plasma physics, and astronomy community. It's
greater than Cornell.
It's very community specific. Well, eCommons, the goal there would be to have a place where all scholarly work produced at Cornell University. So Archive, people from all over, not just Cornell, deposit articles there. But eCommons, the idea would be all scholarly work from Cornell. Now, I agree with you completely that you know, there's an inconsistency there. We want to have only well-vetted, peer-reviewed information, which costs money to do a good job of reviewing it, and then have that information be freely available. And that's why I think it's important to realize that this is not about making all of that process free. It's not about circumventing peer review. It's mostly about shifting the cost to the producer of information and away from the consumer of information.
Hold on, Cora.
Correct. Correct. So Archive. So the question about Archive. Archive is a quite open repository.
Mm-hmm.
So preprints, postprints. Often there's multiple versions of papers that are in there. The system is good. It links them together. In fact, there's some areas of physics where people have started to post the paper to Archive and wait 6 months to see what kind of emails they get from people commenting about the work and use that feedback to revise the paper before a first submission even. So that's very specific to certain areas of physics where that's involved. The most institutional open access policies that have been implemented so far are interested only in depositing already peer-reviewed articles. You might deposit the preprint version of it because you retain full copyright, but it would be something that has already gone through peer review. You wouldn't deposit things before that.
Professor Hatch or Professor Wayne?
Would this be something for the Library of Congress to do, especially since it's certainly a mandate? And as Jim says, nobody cares really about the definition of it, as long as they get it.
Right, so I think this is a good question and one that our community is wrestling with. What is the right level for information to be made open access? Should that be happening at the level of individual research-intensive institutions? Should that be happening at the level like these institutional repositories? Should it be happening at the level of funding agencies like the NIH, PubMed Central? Or should it be at some broader scale at the Library of Congress? And my personal experience at the Library of Congress is somewhat disappointing, so I don't know that I would put them in charge of a whole lot.
I'm not so impressed with the federal government, and this being coming essentially from a federal mandate. Does Ed Markey know the half-life of the scientific paper?
So Markey is not one who is particularly advocating one way or the other for open access. So by the way, obviously I'm not involved in decisions about creating the PubMed Central or the OSPP decision on open access policy. So I couldn't really speak to the expertise of the people who are making those.
Just a second, Marty. Sarah, do you have a question?
Yeah, I actually have two. I promise I'll be really quick. I know you have to go. The first thing is you mentioned that e-commons is pretty underutilized, and
right.
I was wondering if the committee could maybe work with some of the introductory courses here, because I know that a lot of at least the introductory science courses require students to complete projects where you must cite a PubMed article, and you painstakingly learn about all of the search functions on PubMed, and it's useful in long term, but you know, it gets students to use it. So asking professors to do something like that could really increase the use of e-commons, at least among the student body.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was wondering if the committee has thought about maybe any negative or unintended consequences of Cornell's subscriptions to the journals that, like, they pay for us, if opening access to our stuff, maybe other journals might not want to have that deal with Cornell, so then we couldn't access it. I don't even know if that's a possibility, but
yeah.
I was just wondering.
So to speak to your second point, this has been, this is a big concern in the scholarly publishing community universities will decide increasingly to drop subscriptions from journals as more information becomes open access, especially non-research intensive universities. The publication costs will still be the same, and it will be an ever smaller fraction of research intensive universities that need that rapid access, and so it could actually drive costs up significantly. Now, whether Cornell does or doesn't adopt our own policy probably has institutional repository policy probably has relatively little influence on that because of the sort of larger scale trends. But that has been a concern in the community. I think to speculate, I would say that we're looking at at the beginnings or maybe the early middle stage of a 20-25 year shift in the scholarly publishing industry. And there's going to be there's going to be a fair bit of creative destruction and fallout that's going to result from that, and publishers are going to have to adopt business models that eventually work with it.
I think that we're at the end of our time. I know I see some hands, so please send me your questions. I will get them to Professor Schaefer and get you back responses. Thank you, and as I understand it, happy birthday.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. I'd now like to turn to the next item of business, and once again I'm asking your indulgence to amend the orders of the day to now turn to the CJC report on limited voluntary advance notice. Because we only have about 15-18 minutes left in the meeting, I want to get through this before we have to adjourn. I believe Joseph Fridman is going to present, is that correct? And everybody should have access to CJC resolution number 2, which is what Joseph will be presenting to us. Joseph, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Everybody should have a copy of CJC Resolution Number 2. This resolution is the result of a request from President Scorton for the Committee on Codes and Judicial Matters at Cornell to consider the topic of advanced voluntary notice, which is the idea that groups that were planning to exercise the right to petition would have some window of time before their event in which they would be asked to notify some body at Cornell, including the Cornell police, as well as some office ahead of time to make sure that Cornell was properly equipped to deal with any resulting issues. The committee found that the judicial, that the documents over which it had a precedent, which were the campus code of conduct, did not have any appropriate need for this, and that the request was very difficult to implement within the structure that we had. As a result, with some rationality of the language for you. Yeah, I'm happy to take questions.
So in summary, basically, President Scorton asked the UA, and the UA forwarded to the CJC, a request to look at a process of limited voluntary advance notice. There was even a sense of some potential language to consider. It's my understanding via, we're basically accepting the report from the CJC today, not voting a resolution out to the president, but the CJC has looked at this, and they've essentially rejected that request. And their rationale is that it's essentially inconsistent with how the code is done and how we want to support outdoor protest activities, peaceful, outdoor protest activities. Is that a decent summary? At the end of the resolution, it also thanks the Office of the Assemblies for their assistance in all this, and thank you. This form that you're seeing, that CJC resolution is not widely used as far as submitting a report, but essentially we know that we owe a response back to President Scorton. The response from the CJC, or as recommended by the CJC, is to not support it, and obviously then we would owe the president some sense of rationale as to why not, which they have stated here. This was not forwarded to members prior to the meeting. I apologize for that. I got it this afternoon, and we quickly got it on a template. So I'm going to ask members to if they've got questions now, to please ask them. I will circulate this to you in electronic form, and I'll ask for your opinion as to whether we want to accept this report and forward it from the CJC to President Scorton, not as a University Assembly resolution, but as the report from the CJC, meaning we don't have to put out a resolution, put it out for 30 days notice, and those kind of things. Or do you want to take it up, rebrand it as a UA resolution, do public vetting before sending it back to the president? That's not a question I expect us to resolve tonight, but if you have initial thoughts or questions about it, we'd like to discuss it and get your initial view as a body as to how we want to forward this. It is quite acceptable for us to accept this as a report of the CJC and in an email format from myself to the president, forward it to him as their response to this, and that the University Assembly is not going to take it up further. Or you might want to take it up. You might disagree with the CJC and want to rewrite and recraft the whole thing. So Your thoughts, Cora?
I agree with the recommendation, but I don't follow the law. It seems like the current campus code of conduct states that things can be regulated, but that it should be a biased manner. So we're recommending that things not be regulated. So that's the final.
Yes, and so part of that is the phrasing of that regulation. There was a sense in the body that it was unenforceable, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the language that and if you look at the code, it's very like I highly recommend folks that are interested in this go to Article 2B3. But it's difficult to phrase that in such a way that makes it voluntary. And we didn't thought we found that.
Professor Booker?
Is there a committee that's looking at face use in campus?
Say that again?
There's a committee that's actually looking at space use.
Yes, there is an outdoor space working group. Okay.
And from my point of view, I don't see how we can actually consider this resolution and the absence of the outcome of that particular resolution analysis and how we should use it to show our space. Because it could be, and I think actually present, there are areas on campus where we do need to commit. If you have language like you have here about commit, and then students assume that it applies to all states. For instance, if I went to Campbell and was running really straight, I could admit.
Yeah, but that's not a protest.
I just said it's a protest. I could come down and say, I want to set the table.
Sure, you could do a lot of things in that regard. But as the code is written right now, there is no need for a permit for an outdoor Mars sticker route.
Yeah,
there is no need.
No,
that's the code.
Exactly.
So regardless of where
order,
you do it,
order.
There's no need.
But we know that the issue that brought this here was about the use of space in front of the street. And unless that's changed, you potentially have the same issue that you incurred with the current language of this particular issue.
I'm interested in what language you're referring to in the document.
Because you're saying that you do not need to have a permit or an advance notice for protest on campus. So what you need to do is then worry about the definition of protest. And that's why I'm worried, because then each and every individual has their own definition of protest. If one man's protest is another man's failure. And I think you need to be very careful. That's all I'm trying to say. Okay? And I just don't see the conversation really revolving around the issue. I think we're actually being somewhat.
And my issue is the distinction, which is that which body we're talking about that would be granting permission. So there are outdoor spaces on campus right now where for me to go there and host an event with my group, whether that is an event, a protest, whatever it is, just to be in that space, a certain amount of students requires permission. That's not what we were responding to. We were responding to the case. That students that are planning to host a protest anywhere on campus generally would have to give some notice, perhaps a day in advance, perhaps a week in advance, to the Cornell police and to other groups. We found that, and that's what we were responding to.
I understand that. But the thing that bothers me about it is that the legislation should be clear for all individuals and what the mandates are. And then some people say, well, I'm suggesting that some clarification, right, say that in some instances it's required. But in general, you said that.
If I can step in, basically what the CJC is saying is they don't want to change the code. They do not want to add any language involving limited advanced voluntary notice, meaning no change to the code. So if you think there's a gray area in the code now, that's a different issue.
There were conversations with all panels where there was a discrepancy between the code and certain rules in terms of space use on campus. So what we're essentially saying is that we don't want to address those discrepancies.
Let me come back to that. Gina, you had a question?
Well, it's part of the same conversation, so I'll follow you.
Okay. Randy?
So this resolution
resolution responds directly to President Gordon's request to insert into the code a request for advance notice for a protest. And then the CJC discussed that that proposal and said that's not protest request into the code. So what this this says is you've asked us when we put that in the code if you decided to do so. Oh, the other issue is still an addressable issue. And that's how the CJC hopes to continue working on it. But this is a direct response to President Gordon.
Correct. This is answering a very specific request from the President.
So, in other words, the bigger issue was still out there. That's right. Although, I'd like to add something on line 20, because I think this clarifies things. Add the word outdoor between advanced notifications on.
So line 20 would read bracket CJC close bracket that permits for and advance notifications of, insert the word, outdoor protests on campus are potentially restrictive.
And that's part of the reason why I'm concerned. No politicians. No, that would not work.
Mr. Friedman, do you accept that as a friendly amendment?
I do. I think that, yes, we were asked to respond to this about outdoor cases, but I would say that that statement holds true for both indoor and outdoor protests.
All right, the word outdoor is inserted and approved.
I think that, that is really good feedback. I'm sorry that that might be harsh to parse the response that might seem out of left field, but I agree that there's a lot of very specific discussion about specific portions of the code. A lot of, we've spent, it's very hard to define active speech. That's what, there's a lot of law going on right now that is very, very, very difficult to do. We were balancing a lot of different viewpoints. I want to show you that this was the result of, a lot of long, considered discussion about this historical
process. And you still have one important thing that you're aware of. What is the protest? And the activity has to be fine when I direct you to close. That's going to be a very important caveat for the rest of the people. So that's really important to everyone.
And that comment is noted. I would then, as part of this discussion, update members. I will remind members, I am the chair of the Outdoor Space Working Group, which is constituted by President Gordon for other questions. I learned in December that the CJC basically was not supportive of his request to put limited voluntary advance notice into the code. I informed President Gordon of that via email in December and said that they have not formally outbriefed or presented the report, but that is the preliminary indication that was given to me by Professor Wayne as the chair of the CJC. And I asked him, if that occurs, does he want the Outdoor Space Working Group to take up this question? He responded, no, he does not. So at this time, he understands that he may receive from the Assembly via the CJC that we do not agree with this request or do not support this request. And he is prepared to move on. I'm sure he will turn these materials over to President Garrett at some point, but that he has not asked another body, he is not attempting to ask another body to weigh in before the end of this term. Professor Hatch.
I'd like to make the possibility of us endorsing this resolution from everything from the top down to line 22, demeaning the and demeaning every line thereafter. And I wonder what the mechanism for doing that would be.
Well, if basically what you've just proposed is sponsoring UA Resolution 2, and why number 2? Because we've only done one other one so far. So by coincidence, it's number 2, not for any other reason. Sponsoring UA Resolution 2 that essentially is the first 22 lines of this resolution.
Yeah, I guess you take out the first 5 and put it in UA. I don't know how it works, but...
Well, we can work the boilerplate, but from starting 7 to 22, and we can put that on the docket for the February meeting, if the members think they want to do that. This is the report of the CJC. The CJC voted this out of committee. They put it in resolution format, and so I just want to clarify. I don't want to confuse things because that's not traditionally how a negative report is issued, but in this case they did. Normally a positive report would be a university assembly resolution that would have been vetted in, you know, for the past 2 weeks, and we would move from there to push it out.
I guess I feel like I would need to call this a report of the CJC. It's a sense of the body resolution, in my opinion. And it's based on the deliberations of CJC, which is our committee for looking at these things. So I'm saying we accept the report of the CJC, albeit in resolution form, but I wanted to, and I actually commend the CJC for putting the resolution form, it's a lot easier for us.
I concur. Thank you to the CJC and all its members. Please pass it on to those who are not present. Professor Hatch has proposed submitting UA resolution number 2. Call that response to President to the President's request for limited voluntary advance notice, removing CJC out of the title, composing of essentially lines 7 through 22 minus the end and at the end of line 22. And with permission, I will clean up lines 1 through 6 as appropriate. Is there a second?
Did you also have a change? Is this going to be a UA resolution?
Right, that's what I wanted.
And then also, so Matt, you didn't mention 119 as well. Because you can't have it as a recommendation.
I will reformat the resolution. The question is, the conceptually, is there a second from a UA member to Professor Hatch's resolution?
Second, as long as we, I think the Office of Assembly is still supporting the process and should be recognized for that through the work of our committee, which is in essence us. So I don't see a necessity to strike that because I do think it's good to publicly recognize those that were supported.
All right. So in other words, I guess one would have to start at the top and say this is not a CJC response. This is a UA endorsement of the CJC view. Of CJC's response, the UA endorsement, so that'd be the title of it. And then I guess you would go down to line 19 and say, the UA endorses the recommendation of the CJC.
I've heard a motion and a second. I would submit a motion to table. Let me reformat the resolution as proposed, circulate it to members via email, and with your permission, once you're happy with it, Professor Hatch, we will put it on the docket for the February meeting.
Sure.
Do I have Professor discussion, Professor Booker?
All I'm going to say is I still, I mean, maybe I'm just too much of a pragmatist. At this point, I do not believe there is actually a rule that says you need to have a committee.
That's correct. The code says you do not.
This doesn't change the code. That is not the issue that arose in the fall, if I remember correctly, of 2015. I think we have a certain service to the university to keep in mind what the outcomes were, and a chairman's position that looks like that may cause again in the future. In other words, it's our responsibility not just to express our feelings, but to actually think about the administration of the campus and how it runs.
One second, Mr. Musi.
When someone tells me that he's not going to permit for a protest, I want them to say, well, all space outdoor Cornell could feel that way, and then kind of include that, if you wish, and then let's have a discussion about what that means.
And
at this point, anyone reading that would think that.
Before I turn the to Mr. Meese, this is a multifaceted problem. The response to the initial Hope Plaza thing came in two parts. One was to reiterate no permit required. That was successfully done. the University Assembly last assembly was unable to resolve the use of amplified sound, which was the other thing we were asked to resolve. The CJC was not able to easily do that, and in the process of that, the Outdoor Space Working Group is working through and making significant headway, I think, in recommendations to the administration on how to resolve those kinds of things that, that irritate. This resolution...
So the CJC, though, Jim, did address the permit and amplified sounds in the resolution it brought to the assembly, and then the assembly
stripped it out.
So these were conversations that I'm glad they're happening again, but should have happened more seriously at the time when the resolution on the recommendation was essentially rewritten at the assembly table.
And the reason they were stripped out was because there was no time use or time and place restrictions adequately oversighted by, you know, the university, which is what the Outdoor Space Working Group is working on. You're right that the president can impose certain things, but where it comes to the campus code, if he implements anything that is current to the current code, he has to brief the trustees and notify us. So to the extent that it would affect actual policy and or punishments under the code, he does have authority, you know, a special power that I have never seen used. But you're right. I don't think we'll lose control. We are out of time for this meeting. Gina?
Ron, just to your point, the question that you raised was deliberated extensively in the CJC, and that was, and it was not unanimous. But at the end of the day, after so much time, both last year and this, the question that you particularly raised is about free speech. It's not one that body could come to agreement on and realize that it would not. And we sort of felt like if the Supreme Court couldn't resolve it, it's not likely to, the unanimous consent. And so it was, in order to move forward, the exception that I take with as how Jim framed it is, this was actually, there was a request made of the CJC, and so the response was, the response may have been negative, but it's affirming that the code should remain intact. And so that is a little different than sort of just negating a request from the president, that after very careful deliberation, this was the recommendation as an affirmation of the code as it currently stands.
And that's fairly stated. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 6:05. I need to bring this meeting to a close. I apologize to all the committees and assembly chairs that we're not getting to your reports. If you have something that needs to go out to assembly members that cannot wait until our next meeting, please send it to me and I will circulate it with the other materials post this meeting. It is 6:06 and we are adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.